May it please the court, Michael Modica for the appellant, Angel Torres. The state's case, the state's prosecution in this case rested on the testimony of Rael Morales, an unindicted co-conspirator who had already entered into a plea agreement with the state. When Mr. Morales gave testimony that was favorable to the defendant, the state had to respond. And the state responded by threatening Mr. Morales with repeatedly that, quote, one lie gets you 10 years, one lie gets you a decade. And the state has said that, well, this was done to clarify the terms of the plea agreement. I suggest that any reasonable interpretation would view this as improper threats. The comments were significant on a multiple levels. Number one, it indicated to Mr. Morales.
Would your position be the same if the comment was perjury gets you 10 years?
Not if he's making a comment that what you just did was perjury, if it's
the significance. Substitute the word perjury for lie. Does that change the outcome from your perspective?
I think lie is a lot more egregious, but I think the context of what was said repeatedly, taken as a whole, it would have been improper even if it was perjury. It's not improper to say, do you understand that, you know, perjury is a crime and it can be punished, you know, by a criminal charge. But that's not what happened here. These were threats. This was done to counter, to send a message to Morales, you just lied, you're risking another 10 years. It sends a message to the jury, me, the prosecutor, I believe, you know, I'm telling you that he just lied, and I'm going to take steps to correct it. And the message to
Does the record reflect any perception by anyone at the time that these were threats?
Well, the fact that, of course, all I have is the record. But during the course of this, when the trial judge tells the prosecutor to step back from the jury, I think that indicates that the significance of how this was approached. He was close to the jury. Immediately, he is confronting the witness with one lie gets you 10 years. Not, and there was a better way to approach this. If he believed that Mr. Morales wasn't telling him the truth, the better way would have been, well, let's refresh your recollection. Let's go back to the tapes. And let's go back to your prior testimony. Not this way. This court has repeatedly emphasized you can't use the term lie, except in limited circumstances. And in this circumstance, I think it is even more egregious because of the way it was used. And repeatedly, three times, plus the message was unmistakable, I suggest, to Mr. Morales. Better come around, as you're jeopardizing your agreement. You're going to face 10 more years. It also, as I've argued, reflects, I suggest, vouching, suggesting to the jury, I know what he said is just a lie. I'm going to get it corrected. The argument in closing where, you know, he has 10 years if he doesn't tell the truth, and he told the truth after I confronted him with this, and that's sending a message to the jury, you know, I have superior knowledge of what the truth is, and, you know, it's his last version that is the truth.
When this happened the first, arguably second and third time, and at the time of the comment in closing, what did defense counsel do?
Defense counsel did not do anything. And I've noted that he did not object, and he should have objected. I suggest it's plain error. This court has the precedent as to the use of the term lie is, you know, it's well established.
There's at least some suggestion that perhaps defense counsel didn't do anything because defense counsel had opened the door to a questions about the plea agreement and the consequences of not following it. Is there anything to that?
We opened the door to a response about the terms of the plea agreement. We didn't open the door to threats and to vouching. It would have been proper to clarify the terms of the plea agreement. Mr. Morales, isn't the terms of your plea agreement A, B, and C to testify truthfully? Not, hey, one lie gets you 10 years. That's not in the plea agreement. That wasn't, in anything written. That is so over the line, I suggest, that it can only be interpreted as a threat designed to coerce a change in testimony and to come in line and to try to please the state.
Well, is there any explanation, if this is one of those you had to be there to fully understand how intimidating the words were or the tone that the prosecutor used or something to that extent, how can defense counsel sit and ignore it if we're to believe it was delivered in the context that you described?
Well, I don't want to be in a position of criticizing trial counsel. We all have our different styles. The defense counsel in this...
Well, it depends on which trial counsel you're criticizing. You don't have any problem criticizing the prosecutor.
Well, it's...
I take your point.
Okay.
Go ahead.
But this particular prosecutor wasn't very aggressive in terms of his objections, and in fact, in one of the other issues that I argue about the repeated testimony regarding prior history of drug dealing, you know, it was the judge who sua sponte would say, hey, I ordered you, you know, can we limit it to these charges? You know, and he kind of sat on his hands. You know, this isn't a Rule 61, so it's tough for me to argue ineffective assistance of counsel issues here. To me, it's so plain, I would have stepped up and objected right away. I think it's just plain error to let that go on repeatedly. And I wasn't there, so I can't answer the question, is this something that you had to be there and, you know, to understand?
Okay.
The next issue is whether there was sufficient evidence to support the trafficking charge for the October 21st, 2006, because no cocaine was ever confiscated in this case. This case is distinguishable from Wright. It's distinguishable from your recent decision in Campbell because the questions were never asked of Rael Morales to confirm, you know, that this was, in fact, cocaine. There wasn't any testimony about his use of it, the appearance, the weight, the smell. And those are things that are present in all the other cases. And even Judge Babiar's question, you know, what do you have other than the testimony of Rael Morales, who's basically giving you conclusions? And, you know, he ends up ruling that the state satisfies its case because nobody had ever complained about it, and then Mr. Tees just did bring to the court's attention, well, that question was never asked. That's not in the record. And Judge Babiar has also found, well, this is consistent with the history of prior drug dealing. After he's already ruled, well, that's inadmissible. And so he used evidence that wasn't in the record and inadmissible evidence to fill the gaps to find that the state had met its burden. And I suggest that under Wright and under Campbell, you don't have enough circumstantial evidence here. Even the drug lingo and the behavior, that's just as consistent with a fraudulent transaction as it is with the delivery of a substance. So I suggest there's insufficient evidence for that. The uncharged misconduct involving the November 2006 that came after, Judge, the court admitted it because it related to the same transaction the prosecution was based upon, you know, in quotes. But he didn't take any testimony regarding this particular deal, This didn't relate to any of the charged transactions. This was a subsequent transaction, and he let it in for one purpose. The state used it for another, and I understand that in Campbell, subsequent conduct can indicate ongoing drug transaction or activity. But this related to a Philadelphia transaction, and while I concede that it's relevant for Getz purposes, the prejudice outweighs the probative value. And one of the questions in the balancing test is the prosecution's need for that evidence. The prosecutor didn't need this evidence. His whole case was based upon Rael Morales. Either you believed them or you didn't. Rael Morales, if you believed the deliveries for October, the two deliveries, then why do you need his further testimony regarding the delivery in that wasn't charged in Philadelphia? Except it bolsters his credibility, which is an improper purpose under Rule 404B.
Well, does it stand to show a pattern of conduct or a common theme?
Yeah, but that's a different prong under the Getz analysis. It shows a pattern of conduct. I agree with that. But then you go under Getz, once you reach that it has a proper purpose for admissibility, then you do the weighing process.
All right, well, that's what you meant. I missed your point. That's what you meant when you said you agree it's relevant.
It's relevant.
But it's outweighed by prejudice.
It's outweighed by prejudice. And one of the issues is, does a prosecutor need it? And he didn't in this case. You had Rael Morales with transaction A and B. Why do you need him for transaction C? If he's believable on those two transactions, what does he add? And
now our standard of review on this is abuse of discretion, right? So it's not like would we individually have decided it differently. It's whether there was an abuse of discretion.
Well, there wasn't. Yes, Your Honor, there was an abuse of discretion because the trial judge didn't hear evidence on this transaction. He assumed, I suggest, that this was like the Grillo transaction that directly related to one of the indicted offenses when he said that. Because in his ruling, he says, I'm admitting it because it relates to one of the charged transactions. But it wasn't. If he would have heard more testimony, he would have learned that this was a subsequent transaction. It wasn't charged. It occurred in Philadelphia. Delaware never would have had jurisdiction over it. So he did abuse his discretion. There's no factual support for the reason that he admitted it, and as he expressed.
Did trial counsel point that out to the judge?
No.
So we're under a plain error analysis here?
Well, he objected to it. This was a motion in limine. They had a hearing on it. And I think once you raise the issue, the judge heard some testimony, made his ruling, and I think once you raise it, that's
Here's the problem I'm having. If a trial judge is being asked to make a ruling and counsel is objecting to allowing this evidence in, and the judge says, well, I'm going to let it in because it relates to something, and counsel is saying to themselves, no, it doesn't. You're mistaken, but doesn't tell the judge that.
Yes.
And then it comes up on appeal, and we're supposed to rule that, well, the trial judge made a mistake of fact that was never pointed out to the trial judge and that seemed to be the explanation for his ruling, and now we're going to reverse on something that would otherwise be an abuse of discretion standard, but we can't use plain error here because you objected. I mean,
well,
I'm having trouble with that one.
To the extent that the defense attorney should have brought it to the judge's attention, I agree. But that doesn't cure or cleanse the fact that this judge made a decision that's not supported by the facts. The bottom line is he made a decision, a ruling, and it's not supported by the facts. It's contrary to the facts. And so that is erroneous. And whether it's a plain error or abuse of discretion, I don't think you can pin it all on the defense attorney for not bringing it to the judge's attention. The last issue I have is this uncharged misconduct issue about the prior history of drug dealing. This was pervasive throughout the trial. The history of the defendant's drug dealing with Morales and Grillo and Wilhide, it was repeatedly objected to. The judge gave specific rulings. The prosecutor continued to elicit testimony about broad prior histories of drug dealing. The judge admonished the prosecutor at least two times to stay focused, and it continued after that. I count five times that I've listed in the statement of facts there was testimony about an improper purpose. The judge ruled, let's focus on these two transactions or what's in the wiretaps. And in fact, the prosecutor kept getting into the prior history, and that could only have infected the jury. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Danielle Brennan for the state. Angel Torres received a fair trial in which no prosecutorial misconduct occurred and all the evidence was admitted properly and was sufficient to support his convictions. If I may address the most recent issue that my co-counsel has brought, or that my colleague has brought up, there was not a pervasive theme throughout this trial of the prior drug dealing. The trial judge made his ruling mid-trial. Raul Morales took the stand. He began testifying. There was a 404B objection. After a couple of questions have already been asked about the prior relationship between Raul Morales and Angel Torres, how they were lifelong friends, and that he dealt in cocaine, Torres dealt in cocaine to Morales. When the prosecutor sought to expand on that relationship, it was only then that an objection was brought. And that's when the jury was dismissed and a 404B analysis was completed. It's important to note for other issues that this was the second 404B analysis that was completed by this trial judge. And this was specifically in relation to the prior history of drug dealing conduct between Morales and Torres. The trial judge ruled that while most of this evidence of prior drug dealing behavior between Morales and Angel Torres was inadmissible because it's prejudicial effect outweighed its probative value, the trial judge did say that the prosecution can allow some evidence of this in at trial, only as it relates to the calls and only as necessary to explain and have all this evidence make sense before a jury. It's important to note here that this was not a low-level street deal. These were major cocaine distributors who were dealing in kilos and half kilos of cocaine. It would have led to jury confusion to just start from nowhere and play these tapes of two unknown to the jury strangers calling each other up and ordering kilos and half kilos of cocaine. So the trial judge limited his ruling, and in doing so, it allowed the prosecution to ask limited questions about the background. The questions that the prosecutor asked were in line with the judge's ruling. It was not pervasive. In the testimony of Morales, the objection came after the testimony. That testimony was not then repeated, and the defense counsel did not even seek a curative instruction, and therefore it's clear that the questioning that occurred prior to the objection was proper within the trial judge's ruling. Then there was the testimony of Mark Grillo and Will Hyde afterwards, which counsel now complains of. There was two questions in each of their testimony about a background. was Raul Morales your supplier of cocaine, and had he done that for a year? That was the extent of the questioning. It did not delve deeper into that. And while it is true that the trial judge reminded the prosecutor to stay on course in its questioning of Mark Grillo, the questioning of the witness did not go so far a stretch to violate the trial judge's ruling. Now, in going back to the Getz issue for the November 1st transaction in Philadelphia, I mentioned that it's important to note that this most recent discussion was the second 404B discussion. Well, the first discussion occurred specifically in relation to the Philadelphia transaction that occurred on November 1st. Unfortunately, I disagree with my colleague that the judge did not specifically rule on it. In the appendix at A13 and 14, it is clear on the record that the trial judge here did conduct a Getz analysis in specifically on that November 1st transaction. The later analysis that my colleague is referring to talked about the tapes between Grillo and Wilhide that were played, and that was when they were discussing those tapes under a hearsay. The trial judge specifically ruled under a Getz standard that the November 1st transaction could come in as it had proper purpose under 404B and its probative value substantially outweighed any prejudicial effect. It is the state's position here that Campbell absolutely controls. It is an almost identical set of facts, down to Raul Morales being the same witness here. It passes Getz in every way. It's for a proper purpose. It is not too remote in time. And there was no limiting instruction requested. In fact, it was a tactical reason, which says on the record that the defense counsel chose not to bring more attention to that. In turning to the sufficiency of the evidence argument, there is ample evidence that the drug transaction that occurred on October 21st was, in fact, cocaine. There is proof that the weight was weight of cocaine, and that proof comes from the phone calls. Now, Raul Morales didn't realize it at the time, but his phone was under surveillance. And in that phone call, that fateful phone call where he decided to make jokes with Angel Torres about the weights being off of these drugs, that's what sealed the deal here. Yes, it's true, the state did not get this cocaine and have it tested. It was never seized. That's because of the nature of this investigation. The state took its time. They had these targets under surveillance. They had wiretaps. And the state was only able to seize the cocaine from the November 1st and the October 27th transaction. But that is also what tells you that the drugs alleged to have been trafficked and delivered on October 21st were in fact cocaine. Raul Morales testified that he was a drug dealer for a year. He called up his Angel Torres, his supplier, immediately after the transaction and started joking around with him. I weighed these. The weights were off. And Angel Torres' reaction is what clinches it. He got upset, and excuse my language, but his language was, oh, hell no. He was mad. He said, you have to weigh them again. And, in fact, he didn't just say you have to weigh them again. He told Raul Morales exactly how to weigh the drugs. He said, each of them with the baggies, it's 1.26. He told them that three baggies is a bundle and what the price of that was. It is very clear from Angel Torres' and Raul Morales' actions that this was cocaine and not some fraudulent substance. There was testimony about the weight. Raul Morales told us, no, the weight was fine, when he told Angel Torres that this was a joke. And there was testimony that he went back to his supplier. He returned to Angel Torres within 10 days two times, and that evidence was seized and did test positive for cocaine. And turning to the final two issues, which are somewhat interrelated, no prosecutorial misconduct occurred. In looking at the very first issue and the questioning of Raul Morales, it is just simply not true that there was a change in his testimony. Raul Morales was a somewhat uncooperative witness from the start. And in reading the transcripts, it is clear that the only testimony Mr. Morales consistently gave was, I don't remember. Mr. Morales was here walking a tightrope. He didn't want to testify against his childhood friend. This was a friend of his, and he testified he didn't want to be there. But he couldn't deny the tapes. And when questioned by the prosecutor on direct, he consistently said, I don't remember. You have to hear the tapes. And when he was questioned by defense counsel on cross-examination, that was his answer as well. But what happened on cross-examination wasn't that he yet elicited favorable testimony from Mr. Morales. It was simply, I don't remember, I don't know, maybe, could not have been, it could have been, which is essentially the exact same what he testified on direct. But what happened is that defense counsel started questioning Mr. Morales about the terms of his plea agreement. And unfortunately, the defense counsel, and I'm not saying that it intentionally happened, but it misrepresented the terms of the plea agreement. And by doing that, he left the impression with the jury that if Mr. Morales is sitting here not telling the truth, then the state is going to pull the plea deal, and now he's facing life in prison. But what actually Mr. Morales was facing was the plea deal was the plea deal. That was set. He pled from 86 charges down to a handful, and he was sentenced to 16 years. In the appendix of the state's answering brief is the letter that shows what the actual plea deal is, and that's the substantial assistance letter. Mr. Morales received 16 years on his sentence, and if he testified truthfully and gave substantial assistance at trial, that 16 years was then reduced to 6. Facing 10 years versus facing a life sentence is a huge, huge misconception that absolutely could not have been left with the jury. And it is the, what the prosecutor was doing in his questioning was merely clarifying that for the jury.
Was it as aggressively done as has been suggested by Mr. Monica? Step back from the jury and one lie gets you an additional 10 years in implicit threat?
The state respectfully disagrees with Mr. Monica's assertion that this was aggressively done. For a number of reasons. Mr. Monica said it himself. He was not there at the trial. All we are left reading now is the black and white on the transcript. However, it's important to note that the trial judge had asked the prosecutor to step back from the jury. If this was done in a threatening way, it makes more sense that the prosecutor was threatening the witness on the stand, but he was just asked to step away from the jury, and that could have been for a number of reasons. And looking at the review that Your Honors take at this point, a plain error review, it's just beyond what Your Honors are here to do to assume things from the record, and now we're just left with reading the black and white. The use of the word lie was done because that's what the deal was. If he didn't tell the truth, i.e., if he lied, then it would be 10 years and not a life sentence, which is what was suggested on cross-examination. So the use of the word lie wasn't done here to threaten him or to coerce him or to prevent favorable testimony, because that never happened. And he wasn't saying, if you're lying to me right now, you better tell the truth because we're going to pull this. He was saying, this is the deal. It's true. The deal is not that you get life. The deal is that if you lie, you get 10 years. It wasn't repeated. It was done twice. At first time, it was a sentence where it seemed like a stutter. So it was in one sentence and then asked again a second time, and then it was moved on. The terms were clarified. That was the prosecutor's goal. They moved on, and there was no damage done. And it's clear that the prosecutor's comments were appropriate, not because defense counsel chose to ignore that and was ineffective, but because it simply was not improper for the prosecutor to do. And that goes into the vouching argument in issue number 2 raised by Angel Torres. In closing and in the questioning, the use of the word lie and this phrase, one lie gets you 10 years, certainly was not vouching. In order to prove a claim of prosecutorial misconduct through vouching, you have to show that the prosecutor, through their words, implied that they had some special knowledge and told the jury that this witness should either be believed or disbelieved because of this special knowledge. That simply was not done here, neither in the questioning of the witness, all he was doing was reminding him of the plea deal, and neither in the closing. In the closing arguments, it was brought up, it was simply a statement of the facts that were in evidence. They commented, and in commenting, the first prosecutor in the opening summation commented about the evidence. This is his actual plea agreement. And you, the jury, are the sole judges of the credibility here. That was not objected to, not because trial counsel was ineffective, but because it was proper to say. And then the defense counsel tried to use this to his advantage, because he tried to say in his closing argument, you saw Mr. Morales, he's got all this time over his head. He wants to, you know, keep this plea deal, which is trying to use it to the benefit. Unfortunately for Mr. Morales, he was convicted anyway. But the defense counsel at trial, they tried to use this evidence to their advantage. And in responding to that, in the rebuttal summation, the prosecutor again commented it. In no place did the prosecutor tell the jury impliedly or directly, trust me, believe me. If he lies, I'm giving him more time, so you should believe him. That's not how it was said. It was a proper comment on the evidence, and no prosecutorial misconduct occurred. Your Honor, I don't have any further questions.
I do have one question. Okay. You will recall your colleague's comments that the trial judge got his facts wrong when he made his ruling about the relevancy of the Philadelphia sale. Do you have any comment on that?
I do, Your Honor. And I don't know if on page A14 of the record, it is clear that the trial judge knew what he was talking about when making this ruling. There was a conversation between the prosecutor and the trial judge, and this was in the first 404B analysis I was talking about, when they specifically only addressed the November 1st transaction. And I believe that the comments that, if I can recall, that you're referring to, Your Honor, is about how he thought it was only, the trial judge thought it was referring to the charged transactions and not one in Philadelphia. Is that correct, Your Honor?
Well, my understanding of the argument was that the trial judge improperly admitted the November sale because the trial judge believed that facts in the record supported a conclusion that they were linked, that the November sale in Philadelphia was somehow linked or related to the sales for which he was charged.
That's right, and that is actually not improper. It is the reason why the state wanted sought to put this evidence in, because it is the same people and it is linked because it shows a common theme. The judge, however, I notice in my colleague's reply brief, it alluded to the fact that the trial judge may have been confused in his ruling, thinking that it didn't really happen in Philadelphia, but the record is clear on 14 that the prosecutor said the reason why it's not charged is because it occurred in Philadelphia over the state line. It occurred over the state line of Pennsylvania, which is why we're seeking a separate ruling. And the court responds, okay, I thought so. The trial judge did not rely on any proper information when allowing this evidence. He did go through a Getz analysis. In fact, to Your Honor's questioning of my colleague as to why there were no more specific examples, I believe, Justice Berger, you were asking about what if he didn't object to a certain prong under Getz. The trial court in its ruling on A14 specifically asked defense counsel. He says, I'm not going to go through every single prong here on the record, but if there is a specific objection to any certain one, then I'd be happy to address it. And the response was, no, that's fine, Your Honor. So the trial judge did not rely on any misinformation in allowing this evidence in. He found, rightfully so, it was for a proper purpose. And as Your Honor's decision in Campbell show, he rightfully found that the probative value outweighs any prejudicial effect of this evidence. Did I appropriately answer your question, Your Honor?
I'll find out. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
With respect to the one lie comment that the state's arguing we were just trying to clarify, that doesn't make sense. The only error that the defense attorney made was that the witness was facing life instead of an additional 10 years. If that was the case, why? If the only intent was to clarify that, you don't need the hammering them about one lie gets you this, one lie gets you this. You just say, well, isn't it true that the agreement is if you breach it, it's a possible 10 years, not life? The fact that the term lie comes in, and it's so forceful, I suggest reflects the intent and the purpose of it. He did change his testimony. In my reply brief, I bring out in the 404B hearing, Mr. Morales testified, and the trial judge, it was during the trial judge's testimony regarding the October 27th transaction. Morales says, I don't remember this. I got it in Philadelphia. I didn't get it from Torres. You know, he may have made the phone call. And the prosecutor knew that because he explained that to the judge. He deciphered the testimony, he explained what was happening, and that testimony is different than what you got at trial, because what you got at trial was deliveries being made in Torres' home on that date. And so there was a change of testimony, and I don't think that there can be any dispute about that. With respect, the trial judge, when he made his initial 404B ruling about the Philadelphia transaction, he didn't hear testimony. It was a tentative decision, I suggest. And he said it relates to motive and everything like that. Then he had an actual hearing where he had heard testimony regarding the Grillo telephone conversation. That's when he made the ruling of why the Grillo and the Wilhide transaction were admissible. And it was erroneous because he said these both relate to the transactions that are being prosecuted, and that's not true. So while he initially made one ruling without evidence, he heard partial evidence, made the ruling, and then made the erroneous decision. Finally, the hearing the testimony about prior drug dealing, it's not necessary in this case, and the judge kept reminding the prosecutor to stay on track. And when a jury, I suggest, hears of prior history of drug dealing, it's going to be misused. It's going to deprive the defendant of the presumption of innocence. They're going to say, well, because he did it again, he probably did it this time. And it's just poisonous. And
was there a Getz instruction given?
No.
None at all?
Not that I'm aware of. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.